Good morning. You're all well today, I hope. Thank you for everyone who prayed for sunshine today. I think we're going to hit the 50s, but hang on, it's going to be cold and snowy tomorrow. I think that's a fact. But just listen to a different station and get a different forecast. I suppose the obvious question is to ask whether or not you believe that God can bring new life out of death. Yeah, good answer. You're in the right place. I wasn't going to comment on the first reading until I realized it's really the last four or five verses of the longer story. It's a powerful story. You may or may not know it. It's typically read at the Easter Vigil. But it's a time when Ezekiel himself, who was formerly a temple priest, and he's in Babylon in exile with all the other Israelites. You know, they're all depressed and really lifeless. They've lost their spirit and trust and anticipation of God's presence and God's help. And so we have that vision of a vast field in the desert, and it's filled with dry bones. You remember that story? Okay, here's the punchline. The dry bones represent the Israelite people who are depressed and fragmented. They've lost hope in God, and they live weary, meaningless lives. And so God says to the prophet, "O my people, I will open their graves and have you rise from them and bring them back to the land of Israel. God is not forgotten. I will put my spirit in you that you may live, and I will settle you upon your land that you shall know I am the Lord your God. I promise it, and I will do it, says the Lord." Sounds like he's pretty clear about that. Again, too obvious. Do you believe in the resurrection of Jesus? Do you believe you're going to rise?
Yes.
Have a nice day. Any volunteers to go today?
No.
Say your prayers. Again, I hadn't intended to use that reading, but how can you miss that? You know, it's so I love to see that in film, you know. See these bones clacking and coming together and sinew and skin and flesh and muscles, like, wow, that's weird. But the point is, God inspirited them. He gave them new life. I really say all of that by way of really probably a less popular theme. What's one thing that absolutely has to happen before somebody is raised from the dead? You have to die. Any volunteers? No. It seems too rich an opportunity to miss to talk about preparing well for death. And I don't mean anything by that other than what exactly that says. I'm not saying anything about the age of the community, your age or my age, because people can die at any age, and they can die like that. I'm not saying that to frighten you. All you got to do is read the paper for 30 seconds, and you hear all about that, right? Preparing for death is not an easy process. For most, it's largely ignored until a point comes where it simply can't be denied. We're certainly aware, mostly through the news and sometimes by very personal experience, in a sudden or unexpected death, such a person doesn't have the opportunity to ponder and prepare themselves or others for the end of life. Still, people do have time in various forms of death to ponder and prepare for the end of life in a meaningful way. It seems like a rich opportunity, particularly for all people, really, but particularly for ourselves as Christians. You see, because even now, we're building the legacy of how we die. Through the course of 40 years and funerals and whatnot, and certainly a number of many funerals in my own family and yours, I'm sure, as well, we've seen people die very hard. And I've certainly seen people die in a very blessed and peaceful way. The story of the death of Lazarus is a miraculous story, and it could be a standalone episode. But by the design of John, the gospel writer, the story of the resuscitation, I'll make that point in a couple of minutes, the resuscitation of Lazarus is surrounded by the very intentional activity of Jesus as Jesus prepares for his death. There's clues throughout the reading. How many times does John tell us in these, I don't know, 2.5 pages, that they may come to believe in me? The death of Lazarus really is sort of a trigger. Jesus knows his time is growing short. And Jesus wants to be clear, not only, but particularly in and from and through and about himself, but he wants to be clear about the legacy he's leaving behind. The death of Lazarus was something of a trigger that made it very clear that the death of Jesus was increasingly close. Jesus has already caused the uproar of cleansing the temple. Not a favorable thing to do socially and religiously. Increasing tension and conflict with the religious leaders, and now he raises Lazarus from the dead, and people are coming to believe in him. They're not going to tolerate much more. He knows the end is near. So, again, John writes this in such a way that he makes it very clear of the intentionality of Jesus. It seems odd at first. The one you love is ill. And Jesus is basically saying, well, thanks for telling me. I'm going to stay here 2 more days. He's already got in his mind, I'm going to stay here because after Lazarus dies, I am going to reveal God's glory and I'm going to resuscitate him into new life again. He's giving us that message because it will be Jesus' life, freely given on the cross, that will not be resuscitated. It will be raised. And there's a difference. The scene becomes very tender and poignant. On the one hand, we're seeing the very human side of Jesus in his personal sadness and distress over the death of his beloved friends. Jesus loved all people, but he also had personal friends. And it's very clear that Lazarus, Mary, and Martha were three of his closest friends. He just needed a place to go from time to time, and I suspect quite regularly, to just go and take his sandals off and not have anybody complain about all the holes in his socks. Or he could drink an extra glass of wine or two and nobody would be counting.
You know what I mean?
He had to have his own friends. These were they. So we have the first engagement with Martha. Jesus shows up, Martha comes. If you had been here, he would not have died. It's something of a complaint, but I know even now, God will give you whatever you ask of him. And Jesus says, the punchline, eventually as they go back and forth, I know he will rise again on the last day. But Jesus says, I am the resurrection. Anyone who believes in me, even though they die, will live. And those who are alive will never die. Do you believe this? Yes, Lord, she says. I'm going to let you answer for yourself in about 10 seconds. It's exactly why he writes this. Martha is the voice of all believers. And Jesus makes it very clear. He's revealing his divinity to Martha. I am the resurrection and the life. And those who believe in me will never die. Do you believe this?
Yes.
Good for you and I to say that, is it not? You might say that looking in the mirror and even repeat what Martha said. These words are being put on our lips through her. I have come to believe you are the Son of God, the Christ, who is coming, who is to come into the world. Jesus makes very clear his fundamental legacy is that we come to believe in him, in his dying and his rising, and through his dying and rising, we are all going to get a turn to die, and we will also rise with him. That's our faith, is it not? Now the whole scene then shifts. Mary comes on the scene. And again, we're intentionally told, remember that very intimate and very personal encounter with Mary. Now, I don't know whether she's the one that was delivered from seven demons or not or whatever. There's too many Marys. But John, the gospel writer, makes it clear she's the one that broke open the expensive jar of aromatic nard, perfume, and anointed the feet of the Lord and dried them with her hair. And as I love to say, 3 or 4 or 5 days later, when Jesus was dying on that cross, I can only imagine richly. And Jesus thought, thank God for that woman. I love her. That is a love to die for. You see the emotional strength that that act of love gave him to die the torturous death of the cross? Here we're seeing the legacy of the human Jesus. His empathy and compassion for Mary out of personal love for her and Martha and Lazarus and others. But we're seeing the depth of his human nature, as human as you and I, broken up as you and I, weeping at the loss of his friend. And even ready and willing to show that compassion to Mary and Martha through faith, Mary through affection, love, compassion, and empathy. And we see that again several days later at the Last Supper, where it is that intimate time when Jesus has that interaction with the disciples. It's a time of healing and forgiveness, love and surrender, and complete self-giving of Jesus in the context of the last meal, the breaking of bread, the pouring of a cup, which we now commemorate, believing in the real presence, the living presence of Jesus, because he died and rose again. It becomes clear, does it not, that Jesus is preparing to die well, and he's giving us a model to follow. He knows his death is coming, so he does his inner work of acceptance and surrender, that he might have a peaceful spirit and a willing heart at whatever is to come. He doesn't ignore or deny what he knows is coming. He has every intention to face his death with meaning and purpose. He intends to embrace the cross with perfect love, a willing desire, and a full-hearted peace. And it is with that love, with that willingness, as John presents Jesus as always being in control. No one takes my life. I freely lay it down. We're going to hear next week at the reading of the Passion. I freely lay it down. It's what makes the death of Jesus not only meaningful, but redemptive. It is not the suffering that saves us. It's the love with which he suffered. Jesus is teaching us how to die well. To die well is to hold deeply to the faith that we too will rise with Jesus. Yes, life after death. To die well is to leave a legacy, you and I, of healing and love and forgiveness that frees the beloved survivors from undue guilt, unfinished emotions, or a tormented sense of absence. We should all know that that kind of legacy is not so well built in the last 6 months or 2 or 3 days of life. Possible, but better that we live it well all our lives. It's a process of humility and surrender to love faithfully through the journey of daily life. I used the example yesterday of a couple. I said my first marriage, as opposed to my second or third. The first couple I ever married. She came back 4, 5, 6 weeks later in tears. I said, "My gosh, what's the matter? You were just married." "Well, I'm lonely." I said, "You're lonely?" His life never changed. He played hockey all winter and he played softball all summer. She stayed home. That would be not a very meaningful legacy, do you think? So we had a conversation. I don't know what, I never heard from her again. And I don't know that I expected to. I wonder how long that was, 40 years ago. Do you think they're still married? He may be playing hockey and softball for all I know. But if he is, he's not married to her anymore. It's a kind of a legacy, isn't it? We all have the opportunity to create a legacy here and not have to wait till hereafter. It's true, the story of raising Lazarus is a miracle, clearly. It's a work of God. It's a divine action. But he was resuscitated. He did, at some time later, die again. Resurrection is permanent, and it gives us a new and glorified body. Do you believe that?
Yes.
I do. I'm going to ask God if I can be a lot taller. Many of us will say, "Well, I want to be a lot thinner." In a glorified body, I don't think it's going to matter. But you see the difference then. So it might leave us with the pondering, because we'll never know how Lazarus or Martha or Mary lived the remaining years after they were steeped in the vivid experience of the realized faith, knowing that God was real. It's hard for us to know how real God is if we're just practicing church religion. These stories are here so we can feel an encounter of God, an experience of God. I don't think there's probably anybody here that hasn't been touched by the sudden death of a loved one. I know there's nobody here that hasn't lost someone. We're all old enough to have lost and have had funerals. I don't know how many of you know Linda Collins. Linda is here, is the sister of Ron Bertolini. Her husband was killed on Thursday in a trucking accident in Illinois. Just like that. Killed instantly. She seems to be doing okay. She was at the healing mass yesterday. You know, there were, I don't know, Debbie, how many were there? 30, 35 people? I think the most people we've ever had for that healing mass. We were here till almost 6:45. And after mass, the healing teams have dinner together. And so I got back to the rectory about 9:15, almost past my bedtime. And there was a phone call. And as far as I can determine, it was yesterday early that my niece Sarah died. Sarah was 46. Toward the end of last summer, she began what we think was a stroke. And she was found to have the same genetic anomaly that many of the men in my family have, that I have. Lost the two brothers, which you know about. They treated her and she recovered, but not very well. And apparently there were some medical issues that the family was not particularly aware of, so she either had a stroke or a heart attack. She was at Michigan State, had driven a friend there who was to be honored for some reason or another. So she had this medical event, and they were not able to revive her. Sudden death at 46. Of course, my brother, my remaining surviving brother, is very broken up, as is his other son, Joe. There were only just Sarah and Joe. So again, we're all going to get a turn. Now, this isn't about feeling guilty, isn't about being afraid. It's about faith. Sarah was a beautiful person. She had her struggles like everybody else. She was a teacher. She taught high school, chemistry, and math for several years before she was in her current position. She worked with a lot of the kids in high school that didn't fit into the mainstream of classes. And she did that for a couple years. She was highly empathetic and very compassionate. These stories can help all of us. But we have to not only understand them, we come to understand them by standing under them. Because this experience of Jesus, of Martha and Mary and Lazarus, is at some point our experience. Preparing to die well is a season of life, and it doesn't happen in the last 3 days. We all have seasons of life. I won't go through the ages. I did that at Mass last night. And you know, the final age, I guess the final season of life is pretty quickly after 65. Sorry. And all the people that are 70 and older, well, where does that leave us? I don't know. Look in the mirror. The best way to create a good legacy of dying well is to have a legacy of having lived well. We pray for Richard Collins and the repose of his soul. Please pray for my niece, Sarah Esper, for the release of her soul, which I'm sure is already with the good Lord. May God bless us with the grace and peace of a happy death in a long time from now. But in the process, may we live well in love for God, others, and ourselves, so that we may have a happy death in the promise and the peace of eternal life.